C3, number 3B.
Yes. Now we come to the second section of the Christ chapter, starting with animal magnetism unmasked. The previous chapter has taught us and shown us the one infinite spirit, when nothing is real but God and his idea. And now the Christ starts in and just shows that God is always good, that it only has the power of good, that God and good is one. The duality here, I think, is pointed out by the belief that of the wrong sense of theodicy, that God works through good and through evil, that he can use the powers of God and the power of evil, and that that is in his plan. In the Christ this morning we have seen that God has an idea. He has an idea, but that idea now here is presented as only good, and that only is, now, italicized, is that right? Italicized in the text here. She says, mind science is of God, it's of God, and demonstrates the divine principle working out the purposes of good only, and only is in italics. It took her quite a while to come to this altitude of thought, or anyway of statement of that thought, because up to 1909 she was still state in the textbook the maximum of good, however, is met by the maximum of suppositional evil, hence the fight to crush science. There is still a sense of warfare here, a sense of duality, a sense of possibility to crush science. And then in 1909, that's one of her last changes, she changed it over to that central statement of the chapter, the maximum of good is the infinite God and his idea, the all in all. See, in the chapter on spiritualism, she only first stated that all that is real, all about reality, is God and his idea. Now when we come to the Christ part, the Christ chapters, now it is stated that this God and his idea is the maximum of good and only good. And there is no suppositional lie that can try and crush science. Evil is a suppositional lie. So, here we have the sense of oneness as showing the omnipotence of God, good, in working out only the purposes of good. Whereas the dual sense would say that God can use both good and evil, that there is good and evil. You know how Mrs. Eddy says, no, perhaps you don't know it from her unpublished writing, she says, animal magnetism is the sum total of error, and that in itself, nothing, until you attach belief to it. Shows very nicely that animal magnetism seems from God's point of view is just nothing. All it seems to have is what we attach to it. So we make the duality naturally. There is no duality within God. Or at another occasion he said, the only power there is in mesmerism is what we allow it to have. Again, what we. The we is always that which is outside of the oneness of being, which tries to attach something to God and thereby make a duality. Well, let's go on in a hurry. We come to science, theology, and medicine, according to England or America. When reading this chapter, the first thing I think which strikes one very quickly is that everything she is telling is coming from God. That wonderful sense of the Christ from God. That all revelation really comes from God. Yes, Jesus saying in this chapter, my doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me. And Paul saying, the gospel which was preached of me is not of the man, but by the revelation of Jesus Christ. And then she says of herself, no human pen nor tongue taught me the science contained in this book, Science and Health. And shows how she received the revelation direct from God. Mrs. Eddy received the revelation not from the Bible, not from human pen and tongue, because it came to her as a Pentecostal influx of life, and then found that verified in the Bible. It is always coming from the oneness of being, never from something outside. When came to me, she says, this heavenly conviction, it was the gift of the grace of God, given unto me by the effectual working of his power. It says quite clearly that all revelation comes from God, and not from anybody, from any book, from any incident or anything like that. That beneath it, fundamentally, it's always God revealing himself as himself. The revelation of truth in the understanding came to me through divine power. Through divine power. It will be quite an interesting question to see what Mrs. Eddy says in all her writings about the part that the revelation of God played and how far the Bible helped or substantiated or verified that revelation. What is it that enabled her to have a revelation? What enabled us to have a revelation? She says it was that sense of Emmanuel, God with us. And so here we find the sense of oneness of God with us. Whereas the duality is that there is a God separated from us, from the we. That there may be two sources of revelation and interpretation, whereas the oneness of being shows that there is only God who can reveal himself to himself and as himself. That all revelation starts from God. But coming to me and abiding in me naturally has an effect. And the second biblical reference in it shows that this effect is what Johnny Morgan also explained, that something is bouncing up, that the pin is bouncing up, and she shows that at that point, through the revelation of Immanuel, God with us, fresh pinions are given to faith and understanding, and thought, see now, thought is rising, the thought acquaints themselves intelligently with God. So you have the two translations here presented through the very fact that God is with us, through the very fact that God is mind, and that mind is with me and with us, so that we have no other mind but that mind which is God. This is the oneness stated herein. And therefore, because we begin to realize that we have no other mind but that mind which is God, a translation takes place by giving up mortal mind, the human concept of mind, and finding myself one with mind, so that I have no belief in another mind. I took that already when I went through the introduction. But here now we have this as the main, I would say, as the main focus of oneness, that because God is with us, therefore we have no other mind but the mind that is God. That because God is spirit, we have no other spirit but that spirit which is God. And therefore through that revelation, translation takes place. By thought, as it is stated, fresh opinions are given to faith and understanding, and thought acquaints themselves intelligently with God. Now thought, intelligent thought, acquaints itself now with God. It is now at this point where she shows how metaphysics is linked up into science. That the moment intelligent thought is brought back to God, its metaphysics becomes divine metaphysics, namely scientific metaphysics, metaphysics embedded in science. And up to this point, Mrs. Eddy hardly used the term metaphysics. Only three times, and only in a casual way, she brought in the term metaphysics. But here, in the sixth chapter, the chapter just teems with the term metaphysics and divine metaphysics. And funnily enough, it is only in this chapter that she links metaphysics with the term God. She does later on link it in a way or the other with a synonymous term or so, but it is here really that she presents how metaphysics now is integrated, so to say, into science and becomes divine metaphysics. And there you have all those nice statements, divine metaphysics is now reduced to a system and so on. The principle of divine metaphysics is God. God is the principle of divine metaphysics. The fundamental proposition of divine metaphysics is that God is all in all and so on. Can you hear that? It seems, and I like to repeat that what I said before I started, it's a tentative discussion which I want to share with you. Nothing definite and fixed, but reading this chapter, I just want to share with you what seems to be the focus or the pith of such a chapter. We come to physiology, the next chapter, and she starts in by saying that physiology is one of the apples from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And you at once get the duality, naturally, of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and that eating the fruit of this standpoint really takes away man's dominion over the earth. So the duality here is presented as working from two standpoints. She says, it is impossible. By the way, when I quote, mostly, with very few exemptions, I quote only from the chapter. See, so that the quote which I give is really not just taken from all over the textbook, but always from within the chapter. It is here, therefore, that it is here where she says, it is impossible to work from two standpoints. And so that the duality here is the belief that we can work from two standpoints. We cannot have two masters, she says here. There is but one way, namely God and his idea. See, it's quite wonderful. In the first four chapters, she never used the term God and his idea. But the moment she came into animal magnetism, up to spiritualism, it was saying all that is real is God and his idea, then all animal magnetism, all that is real, that God only works good, that the maximum of good is God and his idea. Here again she says, and that there is only one standpoint to take, God and his idea. The argument that has to be met here, I would say, is this, that the material must be governed by material means, that the body must be governed by material means, and that the spiritual can be governed or must be governed by spiritual means. The oneness that needs to be seen here can perhaps be summarized in what John Dowley so often used to say, that he says, God is omnipotent in truth and in belief. In truth and in belief. That there is no duality, that God is only omnipotent in the spiritual and in truth, and that he is just helpless in the material. But that it is omnipotent in truth and in belief. So, show even clearer that there is only one standpoint to take in physiology, in dealing, therefore, with duality, dealing with the body, with problems, is shown in the scriptural notes, in the first scriptural note, where Mrs. Eddy quotes, therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat and what ye shall drink and so on. Take no thought of your life. Take no thought of your body. Take no thought of the material. Take only thought for the spiritual. Have only one standpoint. It is really that what John Dowley also used to teach us in regard to treatment, that he said the very first thing you have to do when a problem is presented to it, put it away. Give no thought to it. Don't go out from the standpoint of the problem. Don't try to improve the problem. Put it behind you. Take no thought. So don't investigate the problem. Put it behind you. Turn and turn towards the infinite mind. Go out from mind. What's that standpoint? What knows mind about itself? What knows mind about mind? And go out from that point. So in this chapter there is a great urge to turn from the wrong standpoint, to turn from matter to God. There are quite a lot of statements. It just teems with it when you read the chapter through, and shows that really there is only one standpoint to take, and that one standpoint will take care of both, of truth and of belief. That there is no difference between that. Therefore she says in this chapter that all causation is mind. Mind is the source and condition of all existence. There are therefore no two different existences, a material existence and a spiritual existence, and that we have two sources and conditions of existence. He said, no, mind, capital M, is actually the source and condition of all existence. The divine mind includes all action and volition. Therefore, all action, whatever the action is included in that one mind. Or if it is the action of the body, or if it's spiritual action, there is action, because action is an idea. And there is no other reality than God. So we are not surprised to find that practically all the statements that to God all things are possible are found in this chapter. That wording appears once or twice, I think, in another chapter, but in this chapter it appears many times that to God all things are possible. One just gets the sense to God all things are possible. Under that all is really meant all, not just the spiritual. It's just meant all. All. In truth and in belief. But the solution of it is not to take both standpoints, but to take no thought of your problem, turn away from the problem, stick to your standpoint, and that is the power that controls everything. We have a lot in it that shows God's control over man and body. It's a lot to do with God's dominion over every situation, over the body, over the spirit, over everything. The second scriptural note is he sent his word and healed them and delivered them. You see, he sent his word. There is now the first scripture note was, take no thought of your problem. All right, turn away. Therefore, the second scriptural note, he sent his word. Stick to the word. Stick to the definition of God. He sent his word and healed them. It's, the word is omnipotent in truth and in belief. And so she says, therefore, mind, capital M, is the best friend of the body. It's not only the best friend of spiritual men, but it's the best friend of the body. Mortal mind is the worst foe of the body, while divine mind is its best friend. So the less we think about the body, the more harmonious it is. And so, in this way, we get man's dominion over the earth. I'm doing pretty good. Footsteps of truth. Oh, no. Yeah. Yes. I just 1 minute to the last chapter. You remember that we have seen that that chapter has two parts. And that in the first part, the subject runs through the seven, showing really what the mortal proposition is, the body proposition is. Then in the second part, it's showing what the spiritual proposition of man is. You see why it has two parts? Because it shows that truth is omnipotent in truth, the second part, and in belief, the first part. Or if I turn it out, that truth is omnipotent in belief, that's all about the first part, and in truth, and that's the second part. And if you compare the seven subjects side by side, you will see how they link together, the first of the first part with the first of the second part, or the second of the first part, with always showing, say, just to give an indication, it shows in mind that God is omnipotent in belief, namely over mortal thought. And in the second, it shows that God is omnipotent in enlightenment. See, mortal thought, enlightenment. And so it goes on through the seven in a wonderful way, just showing the balance that there is one consciousness, really, that deals with both. Now I come to the chapter on footsteps of truth. There again, perhaps you remember that we showed that the chapter has two parts. That the first part more or less presents the divine footsteps. The second part, the human footsteps. Each one is built up in the seven sevens. Now, is that a duality? Is there a duality of the human and the divine? And when you read it, you come to the conclusion, you get that sense that there is no duality of human footsteps and divine footsteps. You know how often people come to you and say, yes, science is wonderful, truth is wonderful, but I must take human footsteps. As if they would say, that's all right for your spiritual life, but until that spiritual thing is going to work, in the meantime, I have to take human footsteps, as if they were something separate from it. So, what I feel here, maybe right, maybe wrong, but what I feel here is that in the first part, she shows really the humanity of divinity. And in the second part, the divinity of humanity. Or, put it in other words, in the first part, which show the divine footsteps, show the divinity, the divine footsteps, which are very human, which have a touch of humanity in it. And the second part shows very distinctly the human footsteps you can take and the human steps to be taken in the right way, but that they are always based on the divinity of those human footsteps. So that there is not two. There is no duality of divinity and humanity, but a oneness of divinity embracing humanity. I would perhaps not so much say that, but the first part showing the humanity which lies in divinity, and the second part, the divinity which underlies humanity. Perhaps this way. Just come out now. But it is one. It is one consciousness. So we can't have a consciousness for the spiritual footsteps and then say, until that works, I have jolly well first to make some human footsteps. That's tearing ourselves apart into twain. It is also interesting that in this chapter especially, she deals very much with the term I and ego. Just as to show that there is only one I and one ego, no matter if it shows itself as the divinity of humanity or as the humanity of divinity. That's just the I of which we were speaking this morning. That every event is any event, and in every event and any event, the I am is the law of it. In unity of good, just to take it out of the textbook, she says, human beings are physically mortal, but spiritually immortal. What a statement. That human beings are spiritually immortal. Or that she says, the more I understand true humanhood, the more I see it to be sinless. As ignorant of sin, as is the perfect maker. You see the divinity of humanity. A subject on which John Morgan has talked so wonderfully 2 days ago. Here I feel that the chapter on Footsteps of Truth is showing forth that blending, that oneness of divinity and humanity. The keynote of this chapter may be this one, where she says, already on the second page, the scientific unity, this oneness, the scientific unity which exists between God and man. Well, that she could say practically in every chapter, must be brought out in life practice. Now you get the humanity of it. And God's will must be universally done. Can you? So that sentence shows again that must, you see, that it doesn't mean that with all our human force and will and endeavor, we must try to bring out this unity and that God's will must universally be done. But it just shows, oh no, if we have understood anything about prayer and have accepted that unity, and naturally never left it, because as we go on in the chapters, we never leave the tone and the atmosphere and the attitude of the previous chapter, then that unity must, it can't help but be brought out in life practice. We don't need to fear that we bring out, that we don't bring out something in life practice which we haven't spiritually inward. And also the other way around, that what we have spiritually inward can't help but to be brought out. So we are not going to live Christian Science. Christian Science is going to live us. How can we live Christian Science? The smaller cannot live the greater. That atonement in Eucharist has shown that. So only science lifts us. But science doesn't mean a word. It meant that through prayers, atonement in Eucharist, through marriage, through spirit, through the fourth chapter, we have grown into that unity which is such a force that in the second group of the Christ, it is brought out, that it can't help to be brought out. And so that makes life not so rigid. It makes it fluent. Just a few indications of how she deals in the first part with the humanity of divinity. Therefore, that in divinity there is a lot of humanity. She says that if we take that unity with God by putting all into God, that she says, the whole human family would be redeemed. It would be a very present help in trouble. The whole universe would become harmonious. The world feels the alterative effect through every pore. The worldwide slavery will be banished. Universal freedom established. The demonstration on earth, peace, goodwill towards men, it is the rights of men fully known and acknowledged. And finally, in the midst of imperfection, perfection is seen. In the midst of imperfection, perfection is seen. In the second part, where I think she brings out how humanity has at its base divinity, and that humanity without its divinity at its base is no humanity. She is talking about that the human footsteps leading to perfection are indispensable. Well, if you only read such a sentence out of its context and not in the context of the chapter, naturally you think, all right, there are human footsteps, and I must see that they lead to perfection, and that these human footsteps are indispensable. That the divine demand, she said, be therefore perfect, is scientific, and the human footsteps leading to perfection are indispensable. God requires perfection. Yes, that's the humanity. But she goes on and says, where do you get your authority for it? Where do you get your power to do it? She says, when we wait patiently on God, He directs our thoughts. See, the divinity now comes in. To begin right is doing much. To begin right, well, what is beginning right? We saw it, that we put the problem beside and say, well, there is only one standpoint from which to go out, and that's the divine standpoint. So that the human footsteps are not primary footsteps. There are always footsteps that have to come out of man's unity with God. The human self, she says, must be evangelized. And some try then very hard to evangelize that old man. This task God demands us to accept lovingly and to work out the spiritual which determines the outward and actual. That's the human development, the human footstep. But before she has given the divinity of it and said, I am leading you into the understanding of your heaven bestowed harmony. See, first is always the heaven bestowed. It's always the divinity, and that divinity has in itself the power to bring forth the humanity. All right. You compare the seven subjects, you see in them a wonderful correlation again of the divinity of mind and the humanity of mind, so that the divinity of mind is made manifest in the humanity of mind. For instance, in the divinity of mind, she speaks all about scientific knowledge. In the humanity of mind, she speaks about spiritualization of thought. In the divinity of spirit, she speaks about the understanding of the spiritual facts, you see, quite divine. In the humanity of it, in spirit, she speaks about fostering receptivity. Can you see the humanity of it? And so, if we had time, we could show that very, very easily, that one is the divinity of it, the other is the humanity of mind. So, perhaps I have made a new phrasing by saying that the unity with the divinity of mind brings out the humanity of mind. Can we perhaps say a humanity of mind? That the divinity of spirit really is made manifest in the humanity of spirit. Well, let's just think it over. Now, let's make a break.